The Boston Red Sox took down the Baltimore Orioles yesterday, while the New York Yankees handled business against the Kansas City Royals. Is the AL East over? We'll break that down and more on this episode of First Pitch. Yes, welcome on into First Pitch, your home for daily updates on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. You can follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball, joined as always by Christian Rau. You can follow him on Twitter at Christian S. Rau, R-A-U-H. And Christian, we not a huge slate of games yesterday, 9 total matchups, but still some really interesting results and some explosive action. Boston Red Sox taking on the Baltimore Orioles at home. Rob Refsnyder and Tyler O'Neill went back-to-back earlier in the game, but with it not completely put away, they then turned around and handled business. Refsnyder went first.
Time is key. High fly down the right field line, taking it at the pesky pole, and that ball into the corner, that is gone! He strikes again! He tucked it in there! What a night for Refsnyder. 5 RBIs and 2 home runs.
Not to be outdone, Tyler O'Neill, right after him, did this.
Ball goes up that way. Oh!
Swing and a drive by O'Neill. He got himself another one. And they go back to back for the second time tonight. Refsnyder and O'Neill. What a lovely sound that is. And the Red Sox are blowing out the Orioles in game one. Number 29 for T.O.
Those two guys combined for 7 hits, 8 RBI in this 12-3 victory over the Baltimore Orioles. Now, at the same time, while this was happening, or maybe, I'm not sure the exact times, but at the same time, the Royals were in New York to take on the Yankees. The Yankees won 10-4 over the Royals. So now the lead in the East is a game and a half for the New York Yankees. When you look at the fact that they finally called up Jason Dominguez, and we'll break that down in a second, but is this finally the lead that New York can hold on to win the AL East?
You know what's crazy? They both are 5-5 in their last 10 games, the Yankees and the Orioles, but the Orioles just seem like they're playing a lot worse baseball than the Yankees right now. The slump is really weird with Baltimore, and the pitching's not been great. Although Corbin Burns had a quality start just the other day, but the offense couldn't figure it out. It's been so hit and miss for Baltimore. They do not look like a playoff team right now. For the first time all season, they don't look like a team that's going to make a lot of noise in October. That's concerning to me. However, a game and a half is still not enough for me to be able to say, not enough for me to be able to close the book on the American League East. Not this year. Not the way it's been, how crazy it's been going back and forth with these two squads. I will say, on the other side, for Boston, they're only 3 games back of that final wild card now. You know, we talked about, is it time to maybe close the book on one of those yesterday, when it being 4 games? Now they quickly make it 3 with them and Detroit and a couple other and the other teams there. Mm-hmm. You got to love that. Tyler O'Neill, I love seeing him progress. And he might be easily, when we look back at this after the whole season's over, and I think we can probably, you know, say it now, he might be one of the steal trade of the offseason this past year. He was traded from St. Louis for a guy who was unceremoniously DFA'd and a 23-year-old pitcher, I think, who's pitching like a 6 ERA in the minors. I mean, that's it. So good on you, St. Louis, for getting rid of a guy that really just was a clubhouse guy. Either way, I don't think you can close the book on this American League East yet.
Yeah, very, very Atlanta Braves-esque trade there. So the Orioles, to your point of the offense has been iffy. In the last 15 days, they have the 8th worst batting average in baseball at only .226 with an OPS of .685. By comparison, the New York Yankees have been batting .260 with a .722 OPS, which is not the best in baseball, but it's a lot better than where Baltimore has been. And with the questions that we continue to have about Baltimore pitching, right? About after Corbin Burns, do you have enough to advance in the postseason? It feels like if the offense can come back, you can storm back and take the division from the Yankees. But the Yankees, their pitching for the most part is fine. They moved Nestor Cortes to the bullpen. He wasn't happy about it. He let us know about that, which was really interesting, kind of how that broke down. But it still feels like the Yankees should be favored in this, simply because I feel like right now they're the more complete team on, I'm going to use a football term and say on both sides of the ball. I did get an email yesterday afternoon with betting odds. Not going to name a sports book again. They don't pay us for this. But the Yankees are favored of winning the division, minus 170. The Orioles are plus 140. So the Yankees, 63% chance of winning the division. That's what that breaks down to. So find that really interesting.
Yeah, those are fair numbers. And I think they should be favored. I'm just not ready to close the book on it just because of how wild it's been. And that Nestor thing, I almost want to be okay like with agreeing with him and saying, okay, it might be a little too early to move him to the bullpen, but I think that's actually going to work out great for New York. But I think he had a valid case of why to be upset. When Garrett Cole was injured, who was the opening day starter this year, Lindsay? It was Nestor Cortes.
Yeah.
So moving from Nestor Cortes as your opening day starter to a bullpen guy, I think he actually has a right to be a little upset. But I think it's going to work out really well for New York in the postseason with a guy like him coming out of the pen.
Yeah, he's the one that of anybody you feel like he could benefit the most from a move to the bullpen, because he's never been a great velocity guy. So throwing in shorter stints hopefully can mean that he can do, you know, air it out a little bit more. But I still wonder about, like, did Luis Gil need to go back there instead? He better velocity, could better help out late in games, which I don't think Cortes really does for you. I think Cortes is more of a take multiple innings, piggyback with a starter kind of thing. And Gil feels like his higher velocity, he could go back there and he could pitch an eighth or a ninth inning if you need him to. So one, curious about that. And then calling up Jason Dominguez, is this the move that New York needs offensively, or does it not matter as long as they keep playing Alex Verdugo and or Trent Grisham every single day?
Well, Dominguez only went 1-for-4, so everything that Aaron Boone and Brian Cashman said over the last couple of months of how he's not going to be an impact was absolutely correct, right? Might as well close the book on that one. No, I'm glad they finally called him up. It's long overdue. We've been talking about that for a few weeks now. But I do think that if you are continuing to play a guy like Verdugo, which he made us into a liar last night because he hit a home run, but if you continue to play a guy like him in left field, I think you're still going to have some sort of issues. Now, on the defensive side, the Yankees have been dealing with more, you know, issues of defensively for both corner outfields. Juan Soto hasn't been the very best defender in right field, but obviously you're not going to take him out of the game. I think you have to, once you get to the postseason, you have to make sure that Aaron Judge is not DHing anymore. I think that's a whole different story. But having Jason Dominguez as an option in your outfield is a lot nicer than Alec Verdugo and Trent Grisham. So I'm excited to see him succeed. His 1-for-4, his single yesterday, I think is only just the beginning. I just hope he has enough time to warm up and adjust before the postseason. If not, I think we're going to run into another point where DJ LeMahieu is going to come back and they're going to decide to put him on the postseason roster instead of Jason Dominguez. I really hope we don't run into that conversation.
Yeah, same. Closing the book on the AL East real quick. Bob Nightingale had a tweet yesterday. It was the 5-year anniversary of the Boston Red Sox firing Dave Dombrowski. They were 76-67 at the time. And in his 4 years, he had gone 370-259, 3 division titles, and a World Series championship. Since they fired him, and I'm going to update this stat with yesterday's win, they are 353-356, so 3 games below 500, with 3 last place finishes. Meanwhile, the Phillies are on track for a 3rd consecutive playoff appearance, including a World Series appearance and an NLCS. In retrospect, was firing Dave Dombrowski the right move to do, or is what he does only sustainable for so long because of how aggressive he is at moving prospects to make the major league roster better?
it seems like that's been the case in the past where he completely just blows up the farm to make sure that the major league team can compete and get themselves to a World Series. And, you know, you look at that and you might get upset in the, you know, in the aggregate, what happens afterwards, but flags fly forever, Lindsay. There's a reason behind that. So his strategy has worked in the past. The thing that's crazy about it right now is that he is not doing that with Philadelphia. The farm is still loaded in Philadelphia, but he's also hit on some of those draft picks, Alec Bohm, Bryson Stott, things like that. Whether those were Dombrowski or not, but those guys have hit, and it's helped out for Philadelphia. And they've also spent money going to get a guy like Bryce Harper. He hasn't had to make those crazy trades, really, except just this past year getting Estevez. But on the Boston side, wasn't a mistake. I mean, I think you have to say yes, unless you were planning regardless on moving those guys like Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts, and just knowing you weren't going to pay them, whether Dombrowski was there or not. If Dombrowski knew that was coming down the pipeline, or which he probably didn't because he was fired, he didn't walk away, then I think you're just in this boat regardless.
Yeah. Cleaning up a little bit on that, Bohm was a 2018 draft pick, Stott was 2019, so before Dombrowski, has hit on other picks that turned into tradable assets, you know, whether it was moving guys this deadline, guys at previous deadlines, or even selling prospects they already have. He has hit on, it feels like, an above average number of picks, so there is still talent in the system because he's done a good job at drafting. Moving on to the Central real quick, the AL Central. The Cleveland Guardians beat the Chicago White Sox 5-3. I don't think we're necessarily stunned that the White Sox lost, right? But Cleveland had a perfect game going into the seventh inning in this one. Always notable when you have something like that going on. And at the same time, the Minnesota Twins, we already mentioned the Royals losing. The Minnesota Twins lost to the Los Angeles Angels 6-2. So Cleveland is now up on both the Royals and the Twins. The Royals are 2.5 games back of the first wild card spot. And then in the division itself, they're 3.5 games back of Cleveland. The Twins are 6. Is it safe to say that the Guardians are more likely than not going to win this division?
Yeah, if you had to tell me I had to close the book on one division in the American League, this is the division I'd close over that Yankees-Baltimore conversation we had earlier.
I'm closing the West. I don't think Seattle's got it. Yeah, yeah, okay. If you're closing a second division here.
Good point. But like in comparison to the Yankees-Baltimore conversation, I'm closing the book on Cleveland. I think that they have it under the book, especially since Kansas City has had that slump. They're coming out of it, but they're having a slump in Minnesota. I think we're going to get the Twins here in just a second. They've been dreadful lately. But what a year for rookie pitchers, Lindsay. Joey Cantillo almost throws a perfect game, goes 7 innings strong. I think 6.2 to go perfect on that one. You've had Spencer Aaron Getty go pretty deep for the Houston Astros. It's been a really fun year for rookie pitchers. You got to love what you're seeing there. But when you look at this Cleveland Guardians squad, there was a moment where we thought that these guys were cooked. This again, this American League Central never ceases to amaze me. They figure it out and they always find a way to do something that's going to make us just whoa. And right now it's the fact that they have 4 teams in playoff contention in middle September. Never thought I'd see that.
Yeah. Top 10 in home runs in the last 15 days, Cleveland Guardians. 16 home runs. There you go. Flip side of that, you know, we mentioned the Royals and they've been slumping, 217 batting average in the last 2 weeks. But the Minnesota Twins have legitimately just offensively, it feels like they've kind of collapsed, right? You look at what they're doing. This is something batting 212 with a 609 OPS in the last 15 days. It's 14 games for them. They have 11 home runs, but they've also have 132 strikeouts, which I believe is third most in baseball in that stretch. Granted, they've played more games than most everybody, but still. And then there's some notable like slumps in this. Royce Lewis, who when he's been healthy, has looked like a number one overall pick should look, right? He's been on pace for 40 home runs if he could ever make it through a full season. Right now, he's hitless in his last 20 at-bats with 10 strikeouts. Is there a possibility? We briefly touched on this yesterday. is there a possibility that you actually see one of those other teams, whether it's Detroit, whether it's the Red Sox, come up and take that postseason spot from the Twins, that final wildcard spot?
Yeah, I think there is a valid possibility. You mentioned stats and how the teams looked over the past, you know, certain amount of days. In the last 15 games, both the Twins and both the Royals have the second and third worst team OPS in baseball. Mm-hmm. First is the Chicago White Sox. But other than that, the Twins and the Royals are right behind them. Those are playoff teams right now. But those are playoff teams trying to hold their spot with a couple other surging teams, Boston mm-hmm. being one, Detroit being another, right on their tail. So as much as we thought that this AL wildcard or AL race was going to be over a week ago, it is far from over now.
Yeah, and kind of, you know, the end of this season schedule here for Minnesota, they've got four against Cleveland still. So obviously that's going to hurt them in both the wild card and the divisional race. Three against the Orioles and three against the Red Sox. So every single win for Boston in that series, in essence, counts double. Moves it a full game versus a half game. So yeah, and let's see what happens.
And Cleveland's 7-2 against the Twins this year.
Yeah, so I mean, there you go. It feels like the Twins are in danger here. Last thing here, National League, the wild card, we've been talking about that. It was tied for that final spot between the Braves and the Mets yesterday. It is no longer tied. The Mets go into Toronto, score a run late to take a 3-2 victory, while the Atlanta Braves have a 1-0 loss at home to the Cincinnati Reds, where they get two hit by Nick Martinez. So I got this sportsbook email, came in prior to yesterday's games, and they had the Atlanta Braves with a higher chance of making the playoffs than the New York Mets. The Braves were -275 to make it, which is a 73.3% chance when you translate that. The Mets were -140 to not make it, which comes out to a 58.3% chance of the Mets missing the playoffs. Obviously, prior to yesterday's games, does it really feel like Atlanta should still be favored to make the postseason over the Mets?
I feel like those odds are just based on strictly data of strength of schedule or something like that, because the Mets have the harder schedule, there's no doubt about it, compared to the Braves down the stretch. But if you've watched how both those teams have played baseball lately, I don't think you can, in your right mind, think that the Braves are going to stay in over the Mets, because the offense of the Braves has just been non-existent over the past couple days. And as great as the pitching has been for Atlanta, and as great as you'd love to see the pitching in the playoffs for Atlanta, they might be sitting in some really nice, comfy lawn chairs with a coconut in their hand in October because the offense can't perform.
Last 2 weeks, Braves are batting .223 with a .637 OPS. Oh. And again, they got two hit yesterday by Nick Martinez. They got a single in the first inning, and then he retired, I believe it was 16 straight batters. And then the second single that Atlanta got, honestly, should have been a fielding error. Should have been an error on Noelvi Marte at third base. So they were at home. You feel like a little home cooking on the scoring there. The scoring's notoriously soft at Truist Park, but just a terrible performance. And I legitimately, that was the moment when I said, you know, I don't think Atlanta's going to do it. So like you said, as great as the pitching's been, the offense has not been. We'll break down more of that over on the Braves Today podcast. So go check that out wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube. All right, want to hop into a quick pitch real quick. A couple things to hit rapid fire here. The first one, the Texas Rangers are promoting Kumar Rocker to make his major league debut on Thursday. And, you know, this is an infamous, there's a Mets connection here. Obviously, the Mets had drafted Kumar Rocker out of Vanderbilt with the 10th overall pick in 2021. He did not sign. So they turned around. The Rangers took him with the third overall pick in 2022. My question is this. The Mets used the Kumar Rocker makeup pick, right? The next year, you get to pick one spot after if the guy doesn't sign, to take Georgia Tech catcher Kevin Parada. at this point, would they be willing to swap Parada and Rocker straight up?
That's a good question. I mean, if you're just pretending that the signing never happened and things like that, you know, hoping that the draft went through, I mean, I think you'd have to say yes. Parada's only had a 635 OPS in his minor league career so far, or sorry, in 2024. I mean, having catching depth in your farm system is not a bad thing. But Rocker has been one of those pitchers where you've kind of knew he was going to be pretty dang good once he finally made that jump.
Once he got healthy, finally, right?
Right. When he was with Vanderbilt, he was fun to watch. He had some of the most memorable College World Series memories for me, what he did. And then what he's done so far in 2024 has been really impressive. 1.96 ERA, only a 0.79 whip. I think that's super impressive. Across his entire minor league career, his whip's only 0.88. So I think that if it can translate really well for the Rangers, then they're going to be in a really good spot for 2025. I think we're going to go into the point to where if it does translate well, Lindsay, we're going to wonder and question, and it'll be an off-season conversation that we're going to have. Why didn't the Texas Rangers make more moves to set them up for 2025 at the trade deadline? Because a guy like Kumar Rocker and some of the other pitching things could prepare themselves for another run. And maybe, you know, after having that year off, you know where I'm getting at? I think that's where we might have a conversation.
Yeah. I do think Kevin Parada is, I didn't like the pick when it happened. You can go back and watch old episodes of Locked On MLB Prospects. I was not on Kevin Parada then. You look at what he did defensively. I think it was last season. He allowed the most stolen bases of any catcher in minor league baseball, despite only getting 72 starts behind the plate. He allowed 129 stolen bases, an 18% caught stealing. And that was mostly in high A Brooklyn, not even at like the upper levels, right? This year, he's been better, 70 games behind the plate in Double A Binghamton. He's only allowed 85 stolen bases. So it's still more than one a game, but not almost two a game, right? And then offensively, batting just .208. Was never really a fan of that pick. And in retrospect, they were probably right to not sign Rocker because of the medical issues. But obviously, we saw him need surgery and all of that. But he's definitely a talented player. He's definitely pitching really well now that he's healthy. And it's another kind of miss by New York there. Talking about maybe a miss by a lot of teams, Anthony Santander of the Baltimore Orioles. If you go and you look at his season he's having this year, which I believe is either his last or his next to last before free agency, he is batting .241, but he just hit his 40th home run. Was an all-star this year. 826 OPS is the second highest of his career. The highest was 2020 in a shortened season. He only played 37 games. How great is Anthony Santander's season been for Baltimore?
Yeah, it's been really good. It's been really good to see that, and not many people saw it coming, right?
Right.
I think we were talking off the air that you let something go in one of your fantasy leagues. You let Santander go because you didn't see it coming either.
No, I had the ability to re-sign him for this season on a 1 year contract, and I chose not to. And I traded his rights to somebody else. And of course, I'm not in the postseason in that league, so probably connected there.
But he's the first Baltimore Oriole to hit 40 home runs since Mark Trumbo in 2016. And listen to this stat. I didn't put these two together, and I didn't know this was a thing whatsoever, but he's only the eighth player, the eighth switch hitter in MLB history to hit 40 or more home runs. Mickey Mantle, Lance Berkman, wow. Chipper Jones, Mark Teixeira, Carlos Beltran, Todd Hundley, and Ken Caminiti. That's it.
What a list. Holy cow, what a list. That is wild. It's the free agency pursuit of Anthony Santander is going to be really interesting, I think, next year. He plays a lot of right field. He's played some first base, not a ton. He played a little bit of first base last year. It's going to be really interesting, and I think he's probably going to end up making more money than maybe we expect because he's a proven power bat. His previous high in homers was 33 in 2022. He hit 28 last year, 40 this year. A little bit of outlier production, but still, I mean, still just really good. And my goodness, I don't think we realized how good Anthony Santander was. So great miss by me. A young guy, you mentioned rookie pitchers earlier in the show, young guy doing really well. Paul Skeens has another great start yesterday. Six innings pitched, six hits, one run, two walks to nine strikeouts. And with his outing yesterday, he set the team's rookie strikeout record with 151. He passed Cy Blanton from 1935. He had 142. No word if he's related to Cy Young. That's not how first names work, but I just wanted to make the joke. Here's the wild thing to me. You mentioned like the list Santander's on. Listen to the list that Paul Skeens is on. It's only the fourth, the fifth time since 1901 that a rookie has broken 150 strikeouts in his first 20 games. The other names on this list: Kerry Wood, who had 179 in 1998, Hideo Nomo, 175 in 1995, Dwight Gooden, who had 162 in 1984, and Mark Pryor, who had 154 between the 2002 and 2003 seasons. What a dang list for Paul Skeens.
Yeah, that is those are some names right there. Look at us dropping some legends of the game in the last couple segments here. But you know, absolutely, Paul Skeens is everything advertised and more, what we've seen so far with him in 2024. I'm glad they chose not to shut him down, even though they're out of playoff contention, because we're finally getting to see, you know, exactly what we expected of Paul Skeens, at least hope to expect, right? The biggest thing now is, will his 10-2 record, his 2.10 ERA, his 0.99 whip, crazy numbers, by the way. Mm-hmm. Is that enough for NL Rookie of the Year? You'd think in any other year that'd be a shoo-in, but this year, is that enough? Is that even enough for second place, Lindsay? Like, this is a crazy year for NL Rookie of the Year, and Paul Skeens is doing some really interesting and really impressive things with the baseball.
He absolutely is. Okay, going from a team full of young talent to a team that has not shown a lot of talent, Chicago White Sox. 33-112 right now. They're 2-8 in their last 10, and they are closing in on the worst record in baseball history. Chris Getz, the general manager, had a interesting quote from yesterday. I couldn't find video of it, but I have the transcript. And I'll remind you, he was promoted to GM August 31st of last year. He had been the director of player development through 2020. And then he became assistant GM in 21 and then now GM. And he said, quote, "If you would have told me we were going to end up flirting with the record," and by that he means the worst record of all time, "I would have been a little surprised. Now, if you would have told me prior to the year that we would have ended up with over 100 losses, 105, 110, I wouldn't have been as surprised." So the quote's not great, right? He, in essence, is saying we knew this team was going to suck entering the year. And it can be argued that there's things that they could have done to maybe be a little more competitive, especially because with the new rules on the lottery, they can't pick in the top 10 this year. So there's almost no benefit to being this bad other than, yes, you save money for your owner, right? Your owner just makes more money because your expenditures are lower. But I want to get into, I want to just rant for a second about this trend of general managers not understanding the ramifications of the words that they say, right? I think about this, where he is admitting on the record, he knew they were going to be exceptionally bad this year, okay? Up front, they knew this team was going to suck. Like, I think we all expected them to be bad. We didn't expect 110 losses bad, right? And he's saying, I wouldn't have been surprised if he told me 110 losses. I'm thinking back to Jerry DePoto with the Seattle Mariners and the 54% comment. And I understand the point that he was making, where if you can consistently have a winning if your goal is to have a winning percentage of around 540, there's years you will do better, there's years you will do worse, but on average, you will make the postseason more times than not. And the difference in a 540 winning percentage and how often you get in the postseason and make a run, and a .580 or a .600 winning percentage and how often you get in the postseason to make a run isn't that big as far as how often you will do it. But the financial expenditures required to go from 540 to 580 or to 600 are significantly better. Like, I understand the point that he's making. What is with these general managers not understanding how to talk to people like normal human beings instead of all of these, instead of all of this? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. And I'm right with you with what you said. I'm going to take a different route on this aspect in these comments, but I'm right with you that it's a bad look. But how can you think that the White Sox, who are obviously trying to improve, they're not trying to sit in the basement, at least you would expect, or you would think that, because as you mentioned, there's no incentive. So you think you're trying to improve, but after these comments, who in the right mind in the free agency department is going to want to come to Chicago and play for the White Sox other than some last second pickups towards the end of free agency who are going to be signed for 1 year deals, prove it deals, knowing they're going to get traded at the deadline, which we already saw happen with Jack Flaherty, a couple other players on the White Sox this past season. It's going to happen again. This is going to be a never ending cycle if they keep guys like this in that position. So I think you already got to look at Chris Getz and point fingers and say, okay, it's already time. It's well past time, I think, because you're chasing a record, but it's well past time that to put him in the hot seat, especially after comments like this. That just can't fly. Not on a Major League Baseball team. No way.
Just makes no sense. Disservice. I feel bad for White Sox fans. Like, I feel bad for White Sox fans. I've always felt bad for A's. Last couple of years, felt bad for A's fans. Feel bad for Angels fans. I even feel bad for Seattle Mariners fans because the GM admitted, like, we're not going to push chips in to try to win when we have a good team. We're going to consistently build to be above average. Hope we get in and make a run and get lucky. And it's just, it's not the way you would hope that a baseball team would be run, right? You'd like to think a baseball team is about winning rather than being about being good enough to compete and still make plenty of money. So it's frustrating. And I think that's the ultimate takeaway from a lot of these dumb comments is just these teams, the personnel who run these teams aren't invested in winning as the fan base is, as the players are. And that's, I think, the most frustrating part of this whole thing. This has been First Pitch for Tuesday, September 10th. If you're listening on audio, do us a favor. Leave us a 5-star review. If you're on YouTube, leave us a comment down below. Subscribe to the channel. Hit the notification bell so you know when we drop an episode tomorrow. Until next time, this has been First Pitch.